Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to the 483rd episode of the Sales Podcast. I'm Wes Schaefer, the Sales Whisperer, your host. Today we have Bob Mesta. He might be the most interesting guest I've had in 482 episodes. Although, you know, I did do some solo, some monologues. You know, do I consider myself the most interesting man in the world? I don't know. Not really. But this guy, he's unique. He's dyslexic. Still can't read very well. He's written books despite that. He has been mentored by some of the greatest thinkers, businessmen, leaders of our time. He has helped produce, develop over 3,500 different products. He's written a book, Demand Side Sales, Stop Selling, or Demand Side Sales 101, Stop Selling and Help Your Customers Make Progress. We see eye to eye on pretty much everything when it comes to business, sales, marketing, entrepreneurship. We get into how he overcame the hurdles in his life around dyslexia and reading, how he has become so productive despite those limitations. So you are in for a treat. As I've mentioned before, you know, if you want some ongoing help, I just wrapped up our Monday morning call. It's at 9 a.m. Pacific, and you can ask anything. Get feedback in our private group. I get feedback. Folks were working right now on their awe statistics. And if you don't know what those are, if you don't have those in your business, maybe you should join us, theimplementors.com. You can join month to month. You can join at half off. Join us for a year of ongoing support and help for way less money than it should be. But I don't want cost to be a hindrance to you. All right, so come join us, theimplementors.com. If you need help for your business, hit me up at thesaleswhisper.com. Hit the contact us, and let's see how I can help you grow. Get your team on the same page. Bring together your sales team, your tech team, your marketing team, your C-level, the C-suite. Get them seeing eye to eye with your salespeople and vice versa. Get everybody on the same page, sing from the same sheet of music, whatever cliches you want to use. But they're cliches for a reason, because it's true. They're based in truth. You've got to get the right people in the right seats, going in the same direction, on the right bus, blah, blah, blah. It's all true. I see too many silos. Marketing doesn't agree with sales. You know, you bring in an outside team. They don't see the vision as well. They want to take over. I've seen outsiders come in and take over, you know, unless I'm hired to come in and take over, which is pretty much never. I don't work with desperate teams, desperate companies. You know, unless you're brought in to truly take over, like Marcus Lemonis on The Profit, right? He's like, we're 50-50 partners, but I'm 100% in charge. You know, unless you're doing that, you're bringing in outsiders to augment, to strengthen a weak spot. But you're still in charge. You're in control. Okay? But recognize that the steps you've taken, the missteps you've made, or the steps you didn't take, or what led to the problems you're currently facing. So you need to be open to getting advice. You need to be open to taking some new steps or taking steps faster. Maybe you take smaller steps faster. Maybe you take bigger steps slower. Maybe you take bigger steps faster. All right. So, yeah, I don't do well when I'm brought in to just assuage your guilt and tell you everything's going to be all right. That doesn't cut it. But if you do want to grow, if you're open to some input from an expert in sales and marketing and leadership, then hit me up, okay? TheSalesWhisperer.com. I'll help you grow. Now, let's bring on Bob. Bob Mesta, possibly one of my most eclectic guests thus far, and out of 470 some odd, that's saying something.
That is saying a lot.
From Michigan, welcome to the Sales Podcast. How the heck are you?
Thanks, Wes. Excited to be here.
So we've just been talking for 10 minutes. I should have hit record earlier. I learned all these things just before we walk on stage. Yeah, you're an author here. I've got your book, Demand Side Sales, Stop Selling and Help Your Customers Make Progress. But you are dyslexic and still cannot read, but you're an author.
Yeah.
You are an instructor, an adjunct lecturer at Kellogg School at Northwestern.
Yeah.
Lectures on innovation at Harvard and MIT. You've developed and launched over 3,500 products. Yeah. What in the heck? Yeah. How are you doing all of this?
So it's so this is actually the book itself was I've actually worked on probably six books. I've always had to have co-authors, right? Mm-hmm. But I found a company called Scribe Media that helps me kind of talk about the progress that I want the reader to have. And then we actually break the book into systems. And then I talk to them. And I talk to them for 2 hours. We have 14 sessions of 2 hours where we then talk about what each chapter is supposed to be and the progress they're trying to make. And then they go off and write the book for me. And if you were to read this book and listen to it, it literally will sound like I wrote it. It has all my mannerisms, has all my stories. And so they've just helped me get all this stuff out of my head. I've been lucky enough that this is my office here. And I have across the top are my four main mentors. In position four is Dr. Deming. I was his intern when I was 18 years old. Clay Christensen has been a colleague and a professor and a mentor of mine for over 27 years. Dr. Genichi Taguchi is the one who taught me a lot of my innovation principles and tools. And Dr. Willie Moore was my first real mentor at Ford Motor Company in the 80s. And these people literally took somebody who was, I'll say, illiterate. I'll say this, I'm very good at math, but for the most part, reading is very, very challenging for me and writing is very challenging. And so I had to learn a very different way in which to take in information and learn. And so I had to hack my way through both school and elementary school, grade school, and all the way through college. But I was able to kind of come out with a whole bunch of different tools and methods. And so for the most part, I have a small design firm and I basically help people innovate. And one of the things that came up is I've done seven startups. And one of the things I always talk about is how hard it is to sell and where the heck do you go get sales knowledge or have the education to sell. And they teach you a bunch of process and tools and techniques, but it's not taught at business school. So this book is really meant to actually be put into the business schools to say, look, here's how people buy. Can we actually help people understand how people buy? And if we do that, then we can actually understand how to sell. And it then sets up all the tools and techniques that's out there, but there's no underlying quote theory of how to sell, but there is a theory of how to buy, and that's called jobs to be done. And that's what I do.
Very cool. Do you think the challenges you had to overcome, has that made you maybe more empathetic to the struggles? I always say great salespeople have great empathy.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I think the fact is one of the ways I got my internship, I was 18 years old. I sat down next to Dr. Deming. I was at an event. And one of those things, I thought he was just somebody's grandfather. And I asked him 40 questions in 22 minutes. And he just said, wow, you are a curious kid. And I think the whole notion is that I learned through questioning and empathy. And One of the things I talk about is you not only have to listen to what people say, but how they say it.
Yeah.
Because the next question always has to be dependent on the answer that they previously said. So when somebody walks in with a set of questions, it's kind of like you're actually missing the point, that you actually don't understand where people are coming from. You're almost assuming the context they're in, which is just not right.
Yeah. And very few people can do that.
Really? Why do you say that? Why do you say that, that are empathetic?
Well, no, very few salespeople can go in and kind of, like I always say, we're in charge of structure and the prospect is in charge of content.
Yeah.
And so, and by that, and I've done jujitsu now for 4 years, so I quit everything to jujitsu.
Yeah.
My instructor, I'm 50, he's about 54. He has trained for about 35 years. I always get it mixed up. I thought he said he started when he was 19. He started somewhere at 19 to his early 20s. So at least 30 years he's trained. And so when we step onto the mat, and he's much smaller than me, he's maybe 165 pounds. I'm all up 220, probably 225. So I'm much bigger than him, but he's very calm. And he's basically like, bring it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And some of the other black belts, big guys, they'll lay down. They're like, okay, come on. They'll let me like get on top. They're like, yeah. Even after 4 years, right? These guys are totally calm with having a 225-pound man jump on top of them and start that way, because they know that they have the answers. They know they can respond to anything I throw their way. So they're very calm.
When
new people come in, like I had this guy 2 weeks ago, it was the most primal thing I've experienced in 4 years. He's grabbing me. He is literally grunting, almost screaming, I'm a T-Rex, right? And he's got to kill me or I'll kill his family. I'm like, dude, relax.
Right.
But you've got to, it's the time on the mats, right? It's the practice where you're like, okay, whatever you throw at me, I can handle. But you still have to learn the fundamentals. And when you do the fundamentals enough.
Yep.
You can show up without that list of questions. In reality, all the questions are in your head anyway.
Yep. And part of it is to get the right context wrapped around. So So I'm an engineer, and like I said, I've been building things for, the way I usually say it is, I've been breaking things for 50 years. I've been fixing things for 45 years, but I've been building things for 30 years. And it's one of those things where I've been studying, why in the world do people buy things? What causes? So the basic premise around this concept of jobs to be done is people don't buy things. They hire them to make progress in their lives. And so what causes somebody to say, today's the day I need a new mattress, right? Almost everybody can tell me who needs a mattress, who buys it, what's the income, what's the demographic, all that kind of stuff. But like, what has to happen in someone's life to say, today's the day? And so to me, I've been interviewing and being able to understand all the struggling moments that people have and how to overcome them. And virtually every product I've built is focused on these struggling moments. And so when it comes to sales, the fact is like at some point they actually have all the energy. So if I take your jujitsu example, is like you're actually providing all the energy to actually tell them what to do. They know how to read what you're going to do and say, well, if he does that, I'm just going to do this. And they're spending very little energy because in this case, the prospect has to have the energy to make the progress. And so part of this is to actually be able to understand what is going on. What are they hoping for? Why now? And what are the actual things that what are the trade-offs they're willing to make in order to fit a new CRM into their business or to buy a new set of ovens or whatever it is that you sell? The reality is like what you really want to know is why are they buying it? And why are they buying it now? And if you can understand their context, it will actually help you realize that buying is cost. It's not correlation, like correlation of prospects. It's the causality that actually we understand and the dominoes that have to fall in people's lives that help us learn how people buy and why they buy. And that to me is like the premise of this book. So it's called Demand Side Sales because it's how do we actually see the demand side of the world as opposed to the supply side where I have stuff and I need to actually have people buy it, right? Versus the demand side is like, I have a problem and I need something to fit into my life to help me make that progress.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about taking the empathetic eye of the buyer and understanding and the user to understand what progress are they trying to make in their lives.
But how do we get them to lower their guard? Because a salesperson coming up and saying, no, Bob, really, I'm here to help. It's just like, it's just like, oh, I'm from the IRS. I'm here to help. Like, whatever, get out, right? I need my attorney. I'm not meeting with you till I have, I'm represented.
So I've done, I'll say thousands and thousands of interviews. And one of the things I heard was this guy who was switching telecom providers. And as I'm interviewing him, he basically said, well, he'd been with this one telecom company for over 18 years. And he said, well, I invited five people in and eventually I got down to two. And, you know, this one I really trusted. I said, wait a second. You've known somebody for, you know, less than three meetings and you used the T word? Like, what did they possibly do to cause trust? Right. And you start to realize when they start to reflect that, it's like, well, the first thing is they came in and they didn't have a pre-planned presentation. They actually asked me questions about my business like they cared about it. And then when they did, they came back with not one option, but they gave me three options, which actually educated me to some of the things that I could do or couldn't do that I wasn't actually prepared to ask. And ultimately, I got trust when I asked them that, I said, I needed to do this. And they said, you know what? No, I can't do that. And so part of this is to realize, like, how do people, like, trust is an effect. It's not a cause. And so part of this is you have to earn that respect and you have to earn those things. And so part of it is how do you help them get educated about what they're trying to do? And the thing is at some point in time, my belief is that it's set up in a way that we're supposed to mistrust each other. But at the end of the day, if you can be empathetic and you can understand and you can actually help tell stories and help them relate to the problem and start to describe, and they leave better having met with you than not having met with you, they will open up.
So what do you mean trust is an effect, not a cause?
So there are things, so Deming again, and as an engineer, you think about what things are a cause and what things are effect. And you start to realize, like, at some point, nobody goes into a buying situation trusting really anybody. And if they do, it's only because they've had a long relationship before and they're trusting them to actually help do something, but it was earned. And so if you don't have trust, there's things you have to do to earn trust. And if you talk to people enough, you start to realize there are things that you should be doing that earn your ability for some people to say they trust you. So for example, another thing they talked about was like, well, they were responsive. I'm like every time you ask a question, no, they were actually weren't too responsive. Cause if they were too responsive, that would see them desperate. They would get back to me in a reasonable amount of time. They'd actually tell me they got the email or whatever they were going to do. And they'd give me an expectation of when it was done. So there's like these underlying four or five or six things you have to do to get the badge of trust. And what happens is most people just think of things as one thing. If I do this, then I get trust. It's like, no, it's like, if I do one thing, they'll buy. Nobody buys for one thing. It's a whole set of things. And this is where you have to be not only empathetic, but you have to be observant. So the majority of my training in terms of as an engineer also includes basically how I do research, which is through criminal and intelligence interrogation methods. So I literally am asking people questions that and sometimes are way outside the bounds of what the product is, and say like, you know, like what is going on in their lives to say like, you know, are there budget cuts going on? Like what else is going on that basically they're worried about? So what happens is a lot of times we talk about our product so much that we forget to actually figure out the context that people are actually in. And so to me, it's ask questions and shut up and listen is the starting point for almost all, like to me, for all sales.
How do you dig in? How do you get those questions on the table and then not go like, dude, you are crossing the line. You are way out of bounds on
so
this.
So here's the thing,
right?
There's a great book by Chris Voss. It's called Never Split the Difference. And he talks about, he's an FBI negotiator and a CIA and interrogator. And the whole thing is that this is the beauty, is like dyslexia is one of those, it's the greatest gift I would actually never give my children.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things where you say like, hold on a second, I'm confused. I don't understand what that, can you tell me a little bit more about that? The hard part is all those students who got A's have the hardest time of saying that the words, I don't know, or mm-hmm. I'm confused. And the thing is that a lot of times I'll set up a bad question. Okay. this is kind of like a little bit over the line. My thing is, you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but like, let me ask it and maybe we can make it better. They are expecting the worst question in the world, as opposed to like, so what was your budget last year? Like, that's an easy question from the answer. And so part of this is learning the techniques of how to actually set up your questions as a way in which to say, I am very interested, and you have to be genuinely interested in what they're doing. But the reality is most people don't want to take the time. They don't want to actually listen and hear what they have to say. They're looking for the keywords to say so they can tell the next feature. They're trying to connect their features to the benefits that they have to say, like, this is how our product will fit in their lives. And they're trying to move on next, right? Yeah. This book is actually written in a way to think about people who actually sell but don't even know they sell. So, for example, I just spent the last 2 weeks talking to teachers about your job is actually to sell the student the lesson. Your job is to help the student make progress. And so you're not actually selling them, but you actually have to figure out what progress they're trying to make and how your lesson can fit into their lives. Right? A nurse or a doctor have to sell a diagnosis and a rehab program. Like the neither one of them make the progress. It's the patient or the student. And so part of this is that we have to actually understand the demand side very intimately to be able to help. And ultimately they will buy our product or our lesson or our rehab. But the reality is, like, if we don't take the time to learn, just putting it out there doesn't make people buy.
Yeah. Are you saying if you build it, they won't come?
Yeah. So that's the lie I was told as an engineer. I would say, like, just guys, just build it. If you build it, they'll come. And then all of a sudden I build it and they're like, I don't really want that. Like, could you make it this way? And I'd make the changes. They still wouldn't buy it. And then it turns out like I'd build it for the user, but the buyer wouldn't buy it. And then I'd build it for the buyer and then the user wouldn't use it. And it was all this crap. And I started to realize, like, okay, what am I doing wrong? I do these surveys. I get all this information. I build personas. Here's the thing. A persona is like a soulless person, because they're just a person in it, like they're a character, but I don't know how they decide to buy a new CRM. I don't know how they decide, like, what causes them to say, today's the day I need a new mattress. We think we know because we know that part of the context, but it's usually very different. And what you realize is the causality behind what causes people to buy is not that I'm 55 years old and that I live in this zip code and that I have this kind of income and I drive this kind of car and I have these kind of tennis shoes on, right? And so this is where we've confused correlation with causation.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I go back to Deming. He always yelled at me, but it turns out that I realized he was actually hard of hearing. But as an 18-year-old, it felt like he was screaming at me my entire, time I was with him. And it was like, okay, I like almost PTSD.
Oh man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. Yeah. Just on your upbringing and challenges. I mean,
yeah,
going through things now, like my oldest son, he's 23. Yeah. He's legally blind. You wouldn't know. Like, you can throw him a football and he'll catch it. He can see things.
He can hear it. He can hear it coming through the air, is my belief. I believe that inabilities create super abilities in other things.
Yeah. Well, he's got a degree in computer science, right? He just sits very close to the screen, zooms in. He has all these shortcuts, man. I get motion sickness watching him work, but he makes it happen. Right. But it's 2020, you're having to adjust and grow in the 70s, 80s, even 90s. I mean, the internet really wasn't a thing. Mature until just 20 years ago. So how are you getting by? I mean, there weren't audiobooks everywhere. No. I mean,
so I live in Detroit, and one of the things we have in Detroit, and I'm sure they have it in other places, but they had something called Big Trash Day. And my mom was a school teacher in the city of Detroit for 32 years. And one of the things we would do is we had an old Bonneville, and she'd say, whatever you can actually fit in the trunk, we can take home. And so I would bring home all these different things, like hi-fis and records. And so I'd build speakers. I found an arc welder, and then I figured out how to wire it into the house. Like, I did all these crazy, crazy, like, I was clearly one of those kids who had a little too much energy and tried a few too many things. But the reality is I learned by building. I learned by doing. And my mom, she was a remedial reading teacher. She actually took the time to help me learn how I learn. So she would sit down and say, like, all right, here's, can you read this paragraph? And I, like, I can't read it a very linear way. The brain injuries affected both my frontal cortex and then my ocular muscle. So it's the fact that the first thing I would see in any paragraph were all the spaces. And so she got me to actually see the where the largest space is, which meant where the big words. I want you to take a red pen and circle the five largest words on the page, and then or on that paragraph. And then I want you to sound them out, because there was enough space in them that I could actually figure out those words. And so then I should guess, like, what would these five words have in common? And so that's the way I learned how to read. And though they tried to make me read in a very linear way, they gave me, they had a flashcard. They had all these different ways to get me to read. I'm like, yeah, I could never remember one word to the next, but I could remember the big words. And so this is how I ended up learning how to read. So I have very big pattern recognition abilities. I can see mm-hmm. patterns before most people can't. And so this is where, again, I might not be able to read, but I can actually do math very well. And I can see patterns that most people can't even perceive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I learned. And I learned through questions. Like, I was that ridiculous kid who asked 10,000 questions, right? And then you go like, oh my God, will this person shut up? Demi was the first one who basically actually encouraged me to ask more questions. He goes like, you're using questions as a way to build a theory about how something works.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately when you stop the questions, you actually don't have, you actually, without questions, you have no theory. And when you stop asking questions, you actually have a complete theory. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that actually helped me actually learn ways in which how I really learn, which is building and doing and prototyping.
Yeah. So how does dyslexia come into play, like doing higher level math, right? I mean, you've got formulas or
there's no definition. There's no definition of the word. Like, I got to be able to see a word, figure out a word, and then go find the definition of that word, remember that word, and then think of the next word after. Like, when Y equals MX plus B, it's just a set of relationships. Got it. I can draw a picture. So to be honest, I can see an equation and see it in space. Gotcha. I can actually plot it out. So because I could put together the image of it, that's how I would remember it. But the notion of having to know the subtle differences between, like, you know, principle and principle, mm-hmm. and that they're spelled differently, and like, okay, wait a second, now which one is that? And then I got to go back, like, I couldn't.
Right.
I couldn't.
But if you see, if you see, X squared plus 2 equals Y,
yep.
or I do X cubed versus 2.
Oh, yeah. I can see it in my head right now.
Gotcha.
And so the other thing I start to realize is that as you start to look at and interview customers and think of sales, it's actually thinking about the dominoes, the different variables that have to fall in people's lives. Like, okay, the system they had is pretty old. Okay. The fact is they finally have budget for it. Okay. They have somebody new in this department. The fact is it broke down over this time. Like, what are the five or six variables that have to happen for somebody to say, today's the day I got to buy something? And we keep thinking it's like, well, they bought it because we gave them a deal. Nobody buys anything because it's a deal.
Right.
They buy it because something's broken, and they'll pick you over somebody else because of a deal. But the reality is we need to understand the underlying causality of what causes people to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone helps us then figure out the best way in which to sell.
So how quickly can this happen? Or is it, if it's a bigger sale, is this just naturally going to take time? And then, like, where does follow-up and nurturing and all of that come into play?
So there's two frameworks that we use. One framework is called the basically the forces of progress, and that there's a push of the situation. There's a pull of the outcome that they want to happen. There's some anxiety of that new thing that holds them back. And there's some habit they have about the old system that they like. And so part of it is can you size up the forces that are actually at play when they're trying to buy something or to make progress? But the second thing is called the timeline, and that everybody goes through it. And there's six phases to it. The first thing is there's a first thought. Like, here's the thing is if you don't actually have a first thought, you actually can't even hear what people are saying. My second mentor, Clay Christensen, would say, basically questions create spaces in the brain for solutions to fall into. And so unless you're actually thinking about a new mattress, or you're not sleeping at night, or there's something wrong, like I would say, hey, there's a sale at the mattress store. And it literally bounces off your head and goes onto the floor. And so yep. part of it is we have to understand how do we create that space in the brain and what we call the first thought. And then from first thought, they go to passive looking, which is where they go through life and they start to learn about one, the problem, but they actually start to learn about the solution language, right? A lot of times, most people actually don't search for solutions. They search for problems first. And then they actually learn about solutions to actually help them. And then they go to active looking. And this is where they'll actually have three bids and we'll do an RFP and we'll do like they've actually pulled together enough to say it's a problem. And then they decide. And deciding is actually more about trade-offs than it is about the deal. And what you start to realize is that almost every purchase that anybody makes, whether it's B2B or whether it's B2C, selling consumers, you start to realize like there are trade-offs they have to make. And if they can't make the trade-offs, they actually can't decide. And so helping to frame the trade-offs is actually one of the most important things that a salesperson can do, because it then enables them to actually move to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, I always preach the notion of trying to give people three options, because most of the time when people have three things to choose from, the first thing they do is eliminate one of them. And when they eliminate one, then they have two left, but they don't actually compare them to each other. They compare each of those to the one they eliminated. So most of the time people don't pick one, they just eliminate two.
Mm-hmm.
Most people know what they don't want. They actually don't know what they want. And so mm-hmm. part of this is being able to understand how do people buy. And again, this is why it's called demand side sales.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did we cover the six? First thought, passive looking, active looking,
deciding, and then basically first use and then ongoing use. Because once you get to ongoing use, there's actually new struggling moments that come up that cause you to fire the solution you bought. And so you start to realize at some point in time, I need marketing, sales, and customer success to work together, because at some point, every time you actually solve one thing, you actually create a problem with something else.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's the paradox of innovation, right? And so part of it is to realize like they put this in, but now they need training, or they put this in and now they've got turnover. So how do you actually help them with the turnover? Like you name it. The thing is there's always another struggling moment. So it's finding the struggling moments that literally cause people to have that first thought.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And what you start to realize is the way I usually start is I just take the last 10 sales that somebody made and say like, all right, let's talk about what were the elements, what were the dominoes, what were the variables that were in their life that actually contributed to and had to fall for them to buy my product or service. Mm-hmm. And when you start to realize, when you see it, you start to realize like there's patterns, and that these three people bought for this reason and these other people bought for a completely different reason. And so maybe there's two or three pathways. And so maybe I actually have to market differently, or maybe I have to actually start my conversation differently about asking them where they're at.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah. So it's again, think of the dyslexia as a way in which to build a visual story. Think of a movie in my head all the time. And so it's not about me selling. It's about them as the main character to say like, what are they trying to do? And why are they trying to do it? And why are they trying to do it now? And be genuinely curious about kind of the progress that they're trying to make. And how do they know that they've made progress?
Mm-hmm. Is the customer always right?
No. No, half the time they don't even know what they want. So this is the thing is that when we, so this is part of the interrogation thing is they'll say they want this one thing. And if you like, so for example, they'll say, I want a printer and then I need a scanner. And you start to ask, well, why do you need those things? And say, well, in the end, if you don't ask why, you actually realize they're trying to proofread. And I can actually teach them how to proofread on three other devices, so they don't need a printer and a scanner.
Mm-hmm.
So if I just listen to what they say they want, the fact is they actually don't even know what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this is that you have to have them unpack the language of like, well, why do you need this? Right. It's like, well, you know, I want some gel in my new mattress. Well, why do you want that? It's like, well, I want it to conform to me. Why do you want that? It's like, it ultimately goes like, well, I toss and turn a lot and I'm hot at night. And the reality is like, I need a way, which is, well, there's 20 ways I can solve that problem. I don't need to have gel.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of this is to actually help people understand what they really want and unpack it, and also realize that they're more apt to choose what they don't want as opposed to what they want. They'll eliminate as opposed to include.
All right. So what if I sell the best multifunction printer scanner on the market, but I don't sell what it is they truly need?
Right.
Do I help them buy the best thing on the market, or do I have to step away and say, you know what, I don't do that. Here's what you need.
That's the thing that I would say is that this is the I actually want to be able to say no sometimes more often than yes, because at some point in time, if I actually don't help them make progress and they end up buying my product this one time, they're never going to buy from me again. And I might be able to help them with a completely different problem and they might need a printer and a scanner for doing checks. But the thing that they're actually hiring me for is to actually do proofreading. The reality is like, I'm probably not going to help them in that way. Though I can, the reality is at some point in time, you have to be able to understand what progress are they really trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's that ethical part of being able to walk away as opposed to just make my numbers.
Right. But I got 7 kids, man. I got to buy groceries. It's Christmas. Yeah,
so here's the thing is I hear you. And so part of it is like, my thing is let's go find the patterns to figure out who do we actually go target? Because my belief is we're targeting the wrong people mm-hmm. and we're trying to sell them stuff that they don't need. That's never going to win.
Yep.
That's especially my experience of doing 7 startup. Like when you sell somebody who doesn't really need your product, it literally will always come back to bite you. I can't think of one time it hasn't.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I'm sure you've been there.
Yeah. I've worked for some crazy companies.
we
did not always see eye to eye, which is why yes. I have such a checkered up and down past.
So here's the crazy part, right? Is a salesperson, a really good salesperson for a company, is probably the most integrated, smartest person out of everybody in the company, especially in a small startup. Right? You got to know about the product. You got to know about the customer. You got to know about cost. You got to know about delivery. You have to know all these things in order to help somebody decide whether they should pull your product in or not. And so ultimately it's one of those things where I would say it's actually so hard to teach. They don't even teach it at business school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so ultimately the fact is like, this is one of those things where it's very important to realize like, your salespeople have to be some of the smartest people, because at some point, if you actually put somebody in there who's willing to sell anybody anything, I call it the church of finance, but finance is very happy because you're meeting your numbers. But here's the thing is when finance actually blows the numbers and they actually offer a 20% discount if you buy at the end of this quarter, you just actually blew my value proposition with my customers because they can get a deal this month mm-hmm. because you actually made a bad prediction. That's actually really bad.
Mm-hmm. Happens all the time, though.
Oh, I understand. And so part of this is when you start to realize that the sales process is actually run more by marketing and finance than it is by the salespeople.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is trying to actually figure out if we actually understand how people buy, we actually need less leads that will convert more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is where people kept saying like, so one of the things I did is I built houses. It's like, oh, we need, I can get you 1,000 leads. 1,000 leads with a 2% conversion is 20 people. Right. Mm-hmm. My thing is I want 100 people that actually will buy 80 homes. And to be honest, when you think about it, if you actually understand why people buy, you can do those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise it's seen as probability theory.
Right.
It's like, right. It's an equation of some sort. And what I would say is, no sale, no purchase is made that is random. You don't buy one thing that is random. You might not plan on it, but if you actually really take the time to understand it, every purchase is caused. There is a causal set of mechanisms every single time. And mm-hmm. if you choose to say that they're random, then you are left to waiting for people just to show up.
Right.
And waiting is both the company and the salesperson's worst nightmare.
Yeah, it's like the car salesman just hanging out front smoking cigarettes waiting for the guy to walk up. It's like,
that's right,
dude, you can make it happen. You don't have to just sit there and wait.
That's right. Well, and try to find people who are ready. Like, where are they in their buying timeline? Like, yep. I've got a company that sells software that basically comes up and they actually ask people, so where are you in your buying timeline? They go, what do you mean? I'm like, well, are you passive looking? Are you actively looking? Are you in deciding? And they'll ask for description. Oh, no, we're back here at passive looking. So what we did is we actually went from one demo to 3 different demos, depending on where they are. And they were able to almost double sales
mm-hmm.
because they end up giving one demo. And after each demo, it was like, well, we should close. Mm-hmm. It's like, but if you're passive looking and I give you a demo, it's like, how do I explain to everybody else what the problem is and what are the possible different solutions and what else is there? Like, when I need to learn is very different than when I need to make a decision.
Right. Very cool.
Yeah. So it's fun. I'm helping everything from, like I said, software companies and food service, kind of equipment people and, hearing aids and, people.
Like, oh, no, people. No, but not my business. My business is different.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We always hear that. We always hear that. The thing is this, is that it's very interesting when you start to actually ask people, why do people buy? And they'll start to tell me about the person. I'm like, no. I get that's the person, but why did they buy? And they'll say, oh, because we have a great product. I'm like, okay, but that's not why they bought. That's what they tell you. But the reality is, what happened in their life, and what were they hoping for when they got your product in life? I want you to actually make. So when I worked in Japan, they had this phrase that they kept hammering me with. It was called, "I need you to give me technology agnostic requirements for the consumer." And I kept going like, what the hell does that mean? Like, I don't know. They're like, I want you to tell me what the customer wants and why the customer wants it, irrelevant of whatever solution they bought. Huh? I'm like, yeah. Tell me the outcome that they were hoping for. Tell me why they bought it now. And so what happens is once you start to see, like, you take the product out of the picture, you want to see almost their life before and their life afterwards. And then you start to realize there's probably 20 solutions they could have bought. And so it wasn't just your product. It's like, what is it that makes that situation unique that then you can start to market towards, that you can actually help people understand? And you start to realize that these patterns enable you to sell way easier because they're pulling it into their lives as opposed to you trying to push it into their lives.
Yeah. You just got to be looking for it, huh?
I think that's it. You know, like you said it in the very beginning, it's the empathy. It's being able to empathize with people's situation and understand where they're coming from and what they're worried about and what are they trying to actually do and what progress they're trying to make. And a lot of times we're not, you know, I find that most salespeople who go through the motions can't hear those things and they don't know how to perceive it. The subtleties of, like I'll say, the transcript reads exactly the same. Your product is, it's awesome versus your product's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that the first one actually had a little bit of down at the end, which means there was one or two things wrong with it. So they delayed. And so the thing is, the next question should be, so what's not perfect about it versus the other one is like, what's the one thing you really love about it? Mm-hmm. And then you start to say like, why do you love it? So here's the thing is they'll talk about one feature they love. You should ask them why they like that feature. How does that feature help them do something they couldn't do before?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're actually buying it for. They're not buying it for the feature.
Yep. What they can get done.
That's right. It's the job to be done. What's the progress they can make?
Yep.
Awesome.
Well, lucky for you, I've got another interview coming up, or I might talk to you till tomorrow and just ruin your whole day.
I'm more than happy. My thing is if there's questions, love to answer the questions. So if there's people who are listening going like, tell me more, or you get people to pick up the book and they look at it and they go like, tell me more about this or tell me more about that. I'm love to be able to help.
Well, and this was written with me in mind because you have pictures and you have good spacing, so I can stay focused. But where do we send people? You want me to go to Amazon? You want me to go to Amazon. Your homepage Amazon, or what?
If you go to Amazon and look up myself, Bob Mesta, Moesta, or Demand Side Sales 101. I actually have a 201 book that's coming that has all these methods and tools for marketing and sales and customer success.
Mm-hmm.
And then 301 is how to manage the funnel from that perspective. But this is just kind of the basic underlying principles of it.
Gotcha.
Or you can find me on LinkedIn. Again, Bob, Moesta.
All right. I am linking to Amazon and your LinkedIn here in the show notes.
Perfect.
Make it more easy for people to find you.
That's right.
All right, Bob, all the way from Detroit, man. Thanks for braving the cold.
Oh, it's not. It's actually a beautiful day here. It is cold. It's like 30, but it's sunny. So I'll take it.
Hey, we'll take it, huh?
That's right. Take it.
Very nice, man.
Well, happy holidays.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks for coming on. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. See ya.
He's been breaking things for 50 years and fixing them for 45. Gotta love it. So why is today the day. The prospect has all the energy to make the progress. What makes you trust someone? So many good things in here. You know, check out his book, Demand Side Sales 101. Follow this guy, see what he's up to. Because he's up to good things. I hope you got a lot out of this. I know we got some crazy times going on. But look, you could try keeping up with all the tinfoil hat ideas going on out there. You can just focus on yourself. You know, I did my Monday call, producing this podcast, heading to jiu-jitsu, controlling what I can control. Okay, it's the best you can do. So, of course, you need to stay abreast of things so you're not caught flat-footed or blindsided, but you can't focus on it. Okay, you can't fixate on it. When you don't know what to do, when you don't have confidence that you're doing the right things, you're taking the right steps, then you find excuses to fixate on other stuff because everybody else is doing it. Stop doing what everybody else is doing. It's time to zig because everyone else is zagging. Okay, you know, the old adage, you buy when there's blood in the street, but the other part of that is even if the blood is yours, maybe you bought Bitcoin. It went up a lot, then it's coming down today as I record this. Maybe you got some blood in the street, but if you believe in the fundamentals, you find more money and buy on the dip. Okay, do you have the courage of your convictions? Do you know why you're in something? Or are you just following it because everyone else is doing it? If that's it, then you're going to suffer the way everyone else suffers. So it's time to zig because everyone else is zagging. Okay. Surround yourself with good people that push you. I think I'm one of those good people that can push you. Join the group, theimplementors.com. It's the most affordable way to stay plugged in and grow. Okay. If you want some one-on-one stuff, hit me up at thesaleswhisper.com. Do the contact us and you'll get a link to my calendar. All right. Thanks for listening. Now go sell something.